Thank you so much, Bronwyn, and thank you, everybody. It's really a real thrill and honor to be here. I'm a sort of a cheese artisan groupie, and so being with all of you is just thrilling for me. So thank you so much. What I'm going to talk about today is two things that I really love, and I'm going to try and make a connection between them. The two things I love are the British Library, and I also love food. And to do this talk, we're going to go on a journey through the archive and then into the modern food industry. It's perhaps not the most obvious route, but hopefully we'll find a way through together. I want to reflect on what's missing from the historical record and to connect this with what is perhaps missing from industrial modern food production by way of thinking about food as an embodied practice. And where I'd like to start, though, is with this book here that Andy Swinscoe very kindly sent me last year after he'd won the British Library Food Champions Award. I'm sure all of you are familiar with Andy, and probably lots of you are familiar with this book. I was delighted to receive a copy. When I looked inside, it said 73 of 500, so I felt quite special. He wrote inside, he said, "Thanks, Polly, for your support over the last years. This is the record I would have liked to have found in the British Library when I was researching." So I didn't take this personally. The British Library's been around a long time, since 1972 as a national library, but its collections date back many hundreds of years as part of the British Museum Library, so I can't be blamed for all of its shortcomings. But Andy's book and note raised a question. How is it possible, in a collection which is one of the largest in the world, with around 200 million items, growing at the rate of 12 kilometres a year, including one petaterabyte of digital content, and dating back to the 3rd century BC of information, and with the very latest digital content collected every single day, how is it possible that we're missing information about Wensleydale cheese? To answer this question, what I want to think about is what is at the British Library. What is at the British Library when it comes to food? I've already said this is one of the largest collections in the world. Until very recently, we used the branding "the world's knowledge." In these post-colonial times, we became slightly embarrassed about the acquisitive nature of that claim, but it tells you something about the intent that established the British Library. Akin to the 18th century Enlightenment idea of the Universal Museum, the idea of the British Library was to be universal, comprehensive, total. Collections at the library, in broad terms, exist by virtue of two processes. They either arrive by a legal deposit or through the curatorial decisions of one of more or of around 100 curators. One of the reasons, for instance, that our cookery book collections are so comprehensive is because since 1662, the library, thanks to legal deposit, has received a copy of every single recipe book published in the UK. This route is also why we hold the records of the Ministry of Food, DEFRA, and other food-related government departments that have existed over the years. Our legal deposit collections grow at the rate of around 500,000 print copies every single year. The other route, through the curatorial selection, depends on the expertise and curatorial tastes of different teams. This accounts for our collections of international material and content that sits outside of legal deposit, maps, sounds, archives, etc. As a result of these two processes, the library's collections exist and grow, and they do so in every format that information is imparted: books, magazines, newspapers, stamps, government documents, music, maps, prints, websites, podcasts. The scope is vast. And across these collections, it's very likely, one way or another, that food is the single subject which features most often. Because food is the stuff of trade and travel, exchange and wars, it features across almost every single subject area, across every language and across every format. Food is indeed everywhere across the British Library. But it's also missing, and I mean this in two senses. It's often hard to unearth our food collections because relatively little attention has been paid to the subjects institutionally. There's never been a curator dedicated to developing our food collections, for instance. And although we have legions of information about food cookery and the food industry and the economics of agriculture and the regulation of food, there are aspects of the subject which have been well outside the parameters of what has been in scope for acquisition. So if it hasn't come through legal deposit, it sometimes may not exist. I want to venture behind the scenes to illustrate this, starting here with this recipe for lemon ice cream. Written at the back of a small leather-bound diary with a rather smart, though now broken, gold buckle, this is a recipe from the Grace Higgins archive, consisting of old diaries, letters, postcards, cut-out recipes, and photographs. Higgins, who was born in 1903 and died in 1983, spent most of her working life in the household of the Bloomsbury Set artists Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant. Higgins was employed as a domestic servant for them from the age of 17 until her retirement at 70. The Higgins boxes are held in the library's manuscript storage with its floor-to-ceiling, vast shelvings and ground floors in temperature control rooms stretching the length of the library. It sits alongside the Lindisfarne Gospels, Shakespeare's First Folio, the private papers of Captain Cook and Jane Austen's archive, among literally thousands of others. Why is this record of a housekeeper stored there? And why has this hastily jotted ice cream recipe been deemed worthy of keeping? What does it tell us about Grace Higgins and the time she lived? And what does it tell us about the preoccupations and resources of the British Library? Higgins's archive was collected in 2007. It was offered to us by her son, John Higgins, through the antiquarian book dealer Quaritch for £40,000. The Higgins papers shed light on a life dedicated to professional housekeeping at a time when the management of the domestic sphere was changing rapidly. Among other things, it's a reminder that the cultural life of a society, a bohemian set of artists and writers in this instance, has always depended upon the often unsung labour of certain key workers, and often women. Grace Higgins's recipe and her archive unsettles what has typically been collected and regarded as valuable, not only by the British Library, but historically, culturally and socially. Women's food practices in the home and out, have often been devalued or seen as unimportant. Higgins's archive is a record of the domestic life at Charleston, of relationships, affections, and ties, as well as being a document of Higgins's skills, interests, and passions as a housekeeper and cook. The diaries provide insight into the eccentricities of Grant and Bell and their friends, for sure, but the archive also provides a real sense of Grace Higgins as a realized person. Her reaction, for instance, to trying Calvados for the first time, I needed a bath to recover. And the fact that she sent her mum a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover, even though she referred to it as a disgusting book. There are also snippets of her life in the kitchen, recipes for semolina gnocchi, rabbit pate and onion soup, often with the afterthought delicious added to the end. The existence of Higgins's archive, of course, is largely contingent on her association with Bell and Grant and the Bloomsbury Set she worked for. The library would not have spent £40,000 on Higgins's archive if it existed as the record of a housekeeper in a less prestigious establishment. It might have found a home in a local library or archive, but maybe not. It may more likely have been disregarded or forgotten. Higgins's archive and its existence as an anomaly among our collections is revealing. It is a clue as to why, while the library is still awash with food in so many senses, it's also missing so much of food knowledge, especially the making of food, whether in the kitchen or on the farm. Much of this has been the responsibility of people with relatively low status, in particular women or women of colour and the working class, and also, relatedly, because so much of that knowledge is embodied. When I say embodied knowledge, I mean knowledge that lives in people's bodies rather than in documents. Knowledge acquired through repetition, touch, smell, sound, and experience. It's difficult to write down and difficult to archive. A recipe can tell you ingredients, temperature, and timings, but as you will know better than me, you can't tell when a curd has the necessary texture, or if a cheese room smells right, or if a cheese has the right mouthfeel from a recipe. Embodied knowledge was not always written down, and if it was perhaps not deemed worthy of preserving. Embodied knowledge challenges the separation of mind and body. So much making of food involves the mind, the body, and the senses, and that embodiment, or embodied knowledge, is in part, I think, not unrelated to the low status with which so many food roles and identities, and indeed until quite recently food, has historically been ascribed. Even a library as vast as the British Museum, British Library, has gaps. And those gaps in the cases of food reveal something not only about the status of food, but about the state of food as an embodied practice. In a space largely dedicated to being a shrine of the mind, embodied knowledge or information about food is patchy and sometimes missing. In your world, as you are all well aware, the consequences of this erasure or blindness were nearly catastrophic. It's the key reason that knowledge about regional cheese production all but disappeared when industrial cheese production was on the ascendant through the 19th and 20th centuries. The embodied, experiential knowledge of artisan cheesemaking, so often held by women, was not documented and not saved, and so it nearly disappeared. This is why when Andy was looking for the information to fully account for the story of Wensleydale cheese and its making among 200 million items at the library, what he wanted wasn't there. There is, however, one part of the library where this information could have been located, where embodied knowledge as well as empirical detail might have been unearthed if it had included recordings with artisan cheesemakers, and that is the oral history collections. The library holds one of the largest oral history collections in the world. The origins of this collection are instructive. It grew out of and was inextricably connected to the historical movements of the 1960s and 1970s, inspired by labour history, women's history, black history and folk history. It saw a questioning of established hierarchies and boundaries of history making and historians. At the British Library, the oral historian Paul Thompson established an oral history collection through the National Life Stories Association, to collect and preserve recorded histories through life stories of people who are in some way significant to what might be termed the national life story. We hold recordings with Holocaust survivors, steel industry workers, the publishing industry, visual artists, the advertising industry, water industry, sex workers, and many, many more. The collection is vast and eclectic. And in 1999, the library started collecting interviews with people involved in the UK food industry. The project covered many aspects of the industry, retail, manufacturing, as well as specific industries such as the meat trade, poultry industry, and restaurants. The word industry here is not accidental. The emphasis was on contemporary, modern food production. To date, there are 250 recordings. Individually, these recordings, lasting on average 6 to 7 hours, tell the biographical story of people whose lives have been economically bound up with food during the 20th and 21st century in what might loosely be termed industrial food production. And here you can just see a list of some of the sub-projects that exist within that bigger food project. And many of the recordings from them are held on SoundCloud. So if you go to SoundCloud British Library Food, you can listen to many of them or listen to clips from many of them as well. Sadly, what this collection does not contain is an oral history of British cheese. Brackets, speak to me later if we'd like to address this issue. No promises, but this feels like the right room. If it had been, then Andy's Wensleydale quest, I think, would have been much simpler. In the library's oral history food collections, you can find some detailed descriptions of the physical labour, the sensory business of making food. Butchers talking about the visceral experience of slaughter, or chefs talking about the importance of sense of smell and sound in running a kitchen, for example. But because so many of the food recordings focus on industrial food production, embodied knowledge is often missing from the recordings. If embodied knowledge is often missing from the archive, it's also missing from modern food production. The modern food industry, by necessity, aims to remove embodied knowledge from the process of production. The worker is transformed into a manual, judgment is replaced by measurement, and experience is replaced by process. In obliterating embodied food knowledge, the food industry creates so many opportunities to maximize profit, minimize risk, deliver consistency, create brands. But the drive towards efficiency necessitates the erasure or denial of embodied knowledge. And in so doing, I think creates a set of problems or perhaps more contradictions. Our relationship with food is by necessity always embodied, since the nature of consuming food is inescapably and inevitably involves us taking food into our bodies. When we eat, we literally take in the outside world. The nature of consuming food means it's inevitably risky. We have to trust the food we take in. Modern food production, with its emphasis on consistency, safety, and scientific knowledge, aims to obliterate risk. But this removal from the embodied, from the human element of food production, of touch and sense, judgment, and of human care perhaps, simultaneously makes industrial food unstable, untrustworthy in some sense. Food produced by machines in a factory is alienating, and it's alienating because it is disembodied. In the early 2010s, I started collecting recordings with people who were involved in the contemporary intensive poultry industry, arguably the exemplar of modern food development over the last 80 years. These recordings revealed the discomfort experienced by this disembodied disconnect and the issues this created for the poultry industry. I'm going to just give you, we did about 40 interviews, but I'm going to just take selections from two just to try and illustrate this. Towards the middle of a seven-hour life story recording, one senior poultry buyer for Marks & Spencer was asked to reflect on the intensive poultry industry. He noted that, quotes, because chicken is so cheap, people's aspirations and expectations of chicken have lowered. Chicken is, he said, a canvas upon which people paint, because, quotes, in flavour terms, it doesn't really deliver. Asked why what he felt about the intensive poultry industry, he responded in the following way. I won't read all of the quote, but the bit that I've highlighted I think is really interesting. He says, I think if I were to think too much about it, I might struggle with the way that we have exploited it and moved it to such a clinical and efficient way of doing things. I think the food buyer was articulating a discomfort at some level, which always threatens to undermine or unsettle the products of contemporary food production. To resolve this tension, branding narratives have to find ways to reassociate food with embodied knowledges to make food knowable to the consumer. At the time of recording, Marks & Spencer were implementing a strategy to increase their share of the poultry market. This strategy, the development of a new poultry brand called Oakham Chicken, sought to resolve some of the tensions inherent in contemporary production. Oakham Chicken was still intensively produced, but they used a slightly slower growing breed, adding about 2 days to slaughter weight. Oakham is not a real place or a real breed. It came out of a branding discussion because Oakham was synonymous with some idea of place and community. In the following extract, a poultry supplier to Marks & Spencer describes the impetus for the Oakham brand. And again, I won't read the whole thing, but just the bit that I picked out. They talked a lot about it's chicken the way it used to be. We want to have chicken the way it used to be. And I think that the producer's extract suggests that the Oakham brand looks back to a shared imaginary of poultry production, the way it used to be, conjuring up associations with place, this fictionalized Oakham. Oakham is this place and community and association, therefore, with the embodied practices of an idea of raising poultry in the past. Oakham Chicken constrained intensive poultry practices to some extent for a few days, associated the chicken with an imagined idea of place and community, and so provided a practical solution and a branding opportunity to assuage anxieties surrounding the intensive broiler farming. I don't have time to talk about this a lot, and that's a very early counter. Marks & Spencer were sort of first into fresh chicken market, but it's really interesting to me that in their in-house magazine, the way they marketed chicken from the 1970s was still with this idea of as chicken used to taste, like chicken tasting fresh, this kind of idea of a past that's always moving, if you see what I mean. The library's oral history collections reveal not only factual information about aspects of the UK food industry, but allow us to get insight into the ways that some of the anxieties created by the disembodied practices of modern food and how these are experienced by food producers and how the industry seeks to navigate and mitigate them. One of the things that the poultry interviews reveal is that even the most technologically sophisticated food system cannot entirely escape the human desire for food to be connected to people, place, skills, and care. Again and again, producers and marketers find themselves reaching for stories of tradition, locality, craftsmanship, and inheritance. They reach for them because consumers are trying to solve a problem of trust. We trust food when we can imagine the people and practices and judgments behind it. And this, I think, brings me back to Andy's book. It brings us back to libraries' books, the library's collections, and to the work all of you do, which is, of course, why I'm here today. When Andy wrote that this was the record he wished he'd found in the British Library, he was pointing to a gap in the archive. But what strikes me now is that the gap is not simply a missing book about Wensleydale. The real gap is harder to fill. It's the accumulated knowledge of generations of makers, knowledge held in the body, knowledge acquired through practice, knowledge that is often difficult to describe and more difficult to preserve. Archives are very good at collecting what can be written down. They've been less good at collecting what can only be learned by doing, though oral histories, I do think, can go a long way to resolve this in exciting ways. Artisan cheesemaking is not simply the preservation of old products. It's the preservation of a way of knowing, a living body of expertise that sits partly in processes, systems, recipes, and records, but also in touch, smell, judgment, and experience. In other words, embodied knowledge. For historians and librarians, this should give us pause, because if embodied knowledge is not recorded, it can disappear from the historical record. But if embodied knowledge is not practiced, it will disappear altogether. The British Library will always have gaps, every archive does. The question is not whether gaps exist, but whether we recognise them and how we try and fill them. Perhaps this is why I think Andy's book matters. It's not simply a record of Wensleydale cheese, it is an act of recovery, an attempt to capture traces of knowledge that nearly vanished. And that's also why I think your work matters too. Some of Britain's most important archives are not stored underground the British Library. They're stored in dairies, maturation rooms, and cheesemaking sheds across the country. They exist in the memories, senses, and practices of you, all of you. The challenge for institutions like the British Library is to find a better way of preserving knowledge, and the challenge for us all is to make sure that it remains alive. Thank you. Yeah. I think probably not as we're familiar with them and we are partners with them, but I think, you know, one of the challenges, of course, we're very connected to libraries and archives all over the UK and indeed the world. And of course, like one of the challenges and also opportunities for libraries, particularly through digital material, is to be able to connect collections and to signpost. So wherever we can, we do. But there has not been a concerted effort to do that in terms of food. But thank you. Yeah.
That are well
So, I mean, that's a massive question. Obviously, thanks so much, Francis. I really appreciate that. So obviously, like very remedial things, back up, all of those things. I won't go into that. But I think for like really referring back to the question that was just asked, I think to as far as possible, obviously, like making partnerships with those organisations which are have got an interest in the industry and the work you do, and to try and cozy up to the curators or the archivists there, and to find, you know, are there places where they will accept your hard drives, for example, for the last 8 years, so that you have a kind of repository that will be publicly accessible. Because it does seem to me that this is a very unique and important sort of gathering that's had this momentum over 8 years, and that the records from these meetings would be really well worth keeping. The how-to.
Well, yeah. This year, I was tasked with going through our family history of office paperwork that we've been holding for 110 years. So I was flicking through all the paperwork and trying to discern which was worth keeping and what wasn't.
Yeah.
This is just interesting, but is it just interesting to me and to my family, or is this interesting to anybody else? So some things are saved, but then it just sits in a box, and we're going to put it in a different office.
Yeah, in a different box at a different time.
You say that's also fine, yeah. And then we burn that in 50 years' time.
So there's lots of different strategies. Definitely connecting to your local library, your local archive, finding out what they're collecting about sort of local knowledge would be really worth letting them know what you have, letting them know the way in which the story of your work and business is connected to place so that it's part of the history. So that's one strategy. We have got some kind of guides to archiving for businesses, which you all are. But the other thing I would suggest is a very practical is that there are, you know, archival schools, or you know, people being trained in archival skills all over the country, and often many of those that are in like their third years of training are looking for opportunities to do quite kind of smaller scale archiving projects. So you might be able to find a person. I mean, you can of course pay a professional archivist to come in, so that's obviously an option. But if it doesn't, perhaps you don't have the funds for that, you might want to try and find someone who's in a sort of training opportunity, and for them it's a kind of work experience. They get to work in an archive that hasn't been organised, and it's part of their course, so that's also a possible route as well. That would be great.
There's a good article, at least one article about it in Professor Magic.
Okay.
So I have to go back into my archives and find it.
Brilliant. Love to hear about that. Yeah, please. Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, I couldn't. And you know, every one of us has one of these, and these have the most incredible. You know, when I started out, I was on a massive tape machine with headphones, all the rest of it. You can just go to somebody and talk to them and record and archive those recordings. You know, it's so simple. And I encourage everybody to try and collect those memories for sure.
Thank you very much, Polly. Great. Next up, we have Ben Wolf, who really needs